Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark, and I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm spiffy.
I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and controversies, I'm going to need some time to contemplate a very personal tragedy that I have suffered and that really all of us in the Dallas film community suffered last week. With little notice, all five Dallas-Fort Worth area Alamo Draft Houses closed, as well as one up in the Twin Cities that was owned by the same franchise operator. We also lost the Angelica in Plano, so it's been a bad couple weeks here for lovers of movies in the Dallas area. Now, I want to be clear from the outset here that the structure of Alamo is a little bit different. It's a little bit unusual compared to a lot of theater chains. Some of the theaters are owned as franchises, while others are owned by a massive national corporate board, right? So it's kind of like a McDonald's, right? Where I don't know if you've ever worked at a McDonald's, listeners out there, but you have stores that are owned by the overall McDonald's corporation. You have others that are owned and operated by individuals who pay franchise fees to McDonald's for use of the name, et cetera, et cetera. And they all kind of get along together. It's important to understand this for a couple reasons. The first is to clarify that the Draft House writ large is not bankrupt, though that entity did go through a bankruptcy restructuring a couple of years back. The National Corporation is currently owned by Altamont Capital Partners, which is a private equity firm, and they are trying to, my understanding is, unload it to somebody else. The second reason we need to understand this is because it played into why the DFW area chain closed down. In a statement about the move, the family that owned my local theaters noted that the franchise fees alone accounted for nearly 10% of sales last year, some $3.5 million, something like that. Apparently, Alamo National refused to give the local chain relief on those franchise fees and also refused to let them close down the worst performing locations. They weren't allowed to shutter some of the ones that weren't getting audiences. And all of which is to say, I just want to put that out there because I want to make it clear that my local chain of draft houses isn't perfectly representative of the problems in theatrical film going writ large. But still, those were one cost to consider in an environment filled with them, right? So the biggest, of course, is the overall reduction in movie attendance. Theatrical film going still has not recovered to pre-COVID numbers. That issue has been exacerbated by a lack of product in the marketplace, driven by the 1-2-3 punch of COVID production shutdowns, WGA strike shutting things down, SAG strike really shutting things down. Those three things altogether, bad news for the amount of product in the marketplace. Now, there are some folks out there who get really angry when you point out that the strikes are contributing to the reduced number of releases. They say this is anti-labor sentiment. And all I'll say to that is, objectively speaking, fewer movies made as a result of the strike is bad for movie theaters. And you could say the strikes hurt everyone without saying that the actors and the writers are to blame for, say, the studios failing to negotiate in good faith. I was talking to David Poland last week on Bulwark Goes to Hollywood, and he made the argument that the studios wanted the strike so they could have a good reason to shut down a number of productions. They wanted to lower the overall number of productions they were getting into, and this was a reasonable excuse. I'm not blaming the studios either. Everybody's got a little blame to go around here. The decision to shut down work right after work got shut down thanks to COVID was not a good one, in my opinion. But, I don't make my living doing this, so it's only fair to let them fight it out. Either way, it's a perfect storm in the Dallas region. You have a private equity firm eyeballing profitable Dallas locations and looking to potentially score some cheap pickups. You have a lack of product in the marketplace. You have an audience that's underwhelmed by the product that they've been presented with. And you have an overall business model that is perhaps on the way out as it is. Alyssa, I need you to cheer me up here because I'm depressed. I had to see Bad Boys 4 at an AMC like a schlub this weekend, like a big loser. Some guy just sat there on his phone in front of me for like half the movie. It's savagery. There's just savages out there. What is the problem with these people?
Guys, I just had like such a wild idea. Should we run an Alamo Draft House?
No, I don't have that sort of money. Do you have that money? I don't have that. I don't have Alamo Draft House money. I'm just a simple film goer. I'm not an exhibitor.
That's what rich investors are for.
Right. Like, I don't know. Should we crowdfund an Across the Movie Aisle Alamo Drafthouse?
If we got any angel investors out there who want to take a run on an Across the Movie Aisle branded Alamo Drafthouse crossover product, send me a check for $13 million. I'll get right on that.
I will say I have been experimenting with making Across the Movie Aisle t-shirts. They're awesome. We could sell them in concessions. It would be really fun.
Dozens of them. Dozens.
I think it depends on how long my crazed like iron-on equipment thing holds out. But you know, we could sell like maybe even 100 of them. It could be limited editions. We could sell them as NFTs. Like right.
It's like A24. A24 only puts like 13 of any given thing in their shop. They're like, oh, it's sold out. So everybody rushes to get them.
I know.
All right, cheer me up here. Cheer me up. Is everything as bad as I have just laid it out to be?
I mean, it seems like you should move back to D.C. where we have two Alamo Draft Houses, right?
Going to happen.
I don't want to cheer you up about living in Dallas. You should come here and hang out with us.
No. Next.
Get a residence on the Blue Line. You can go to the Crystal City one and be grumpy about how we're always going to the one in town on the Red Line. You'll live here, but you won't actually have to see us. It won't be that bad. But you'll have Alamos, and you won't even have to like drive anywhere because we have a semi-functioning metro system.
I like driving everywhere. Driving is fun. Again, me moving back to D.C. does not do anything to solve the overall state of film going and the theatrical experience. So that's a non-starter.
I'm sorry. You have to pay us more per podcast episode if you want us to fix all of movies.
So let me try to cheer you up here. Let me tell you a story in which maybe things get a little bit better. I think there's two sort of salient, you quite want to call them facts, but sort of perspectives on what is going on with the box office and theatrical revenue. And one is the one that is constantly being sort of harped on by Scott Mendelson, a box office analyst who writes for Substack, great columnist. If you want to follow the movie business, is that films are basically performing the way you would expect them to perform. It is that they are underperforming as a whole relative to previous seasons, but individual films, like when they are films that you would expect to be successes, they are successes. Hence Bad Boys 4, which we are going to talk about later in this episode. It's doing really quite well. Mad Max Furiosa and The Fall Guy did not perform. And yes, critics loved them. We all loved them. But they are the type of movies that have not performed for quite a while now. And so it's not necessarily that audiences aren't willing to go out. It's that audiences haven't been willing to go out for the movies that have been delivered to them. And so if you had something more like a normal release schedule, filled with the types of movies you normally would see in May and in early June, then maybe you would have a box office situation that looks a little bit more normal rather than one that is super depressing. The reason we don't have the normal looking release schedule is, as you said, primarily because of the strikes, because the strikes, like, again, it's just a neutral statement, I think. It's because the strikes shut down most production in the United States for 6 months. When you don't have anything being made, being shot for 6 months, then there's less stuff to put out in theaters. But that is only a 6 month window. And that means that 6 months from now, give or take a year from now, things should be more or less back to normal in terms of what is coming out and what's being released. And so this, entertainment strategy guy, a friend of the pod, who also writes about sort of the business and the how it all works here, has compared this to the recovery period after a surgery. Like, you something's wrong with your body, you go in, you get surgery, and the surgery hurts, and then afterwards, also, you can't do stuff for some number of weeks, right? Or months. But in the end, you actually come out healthier. At least that is the hope for a successful surgery. And his argument is that the labor disputes last year, maybe they lasted a little too long. Maybe they were not exactly, you know, maybe both sides made errors in terms of how they approached them. But like fundamentally, like they were, if you view them as like, okay, this was a normal part of the business of Hollywood, labor is like asking for more in a tough time, studios, whatever, respond. Like that's basically like surgery. And afterwards, there's going to be a tough recovery period. But in the end, you hopefully emerge healthier, or at least as healthy as you were beforehand, right? With your problems basically fixed. And so I certainly can see a scenario in which once we get, frankly, superhero movies spun back up next year, once we have Marvel and the renewed James Gunn-fronted DC universe starting again next summer, I can see a scenario in which next year, box office looks, if not precisely like pre-COVID summers, it looks basically normal and healthy. That's the other thing here that we haven't talked about just sort of specifically is superhero movies have driven so much box office over the past decade plus, and there isn't a big superhero movie this summer so far. The only big Marvel movie we are getting this year is Deadpool and Wolverine, whatever it is, which isn't coming till late July. But so, like, typically Marvel owns the first week of May, and if I recall correctly, the Marvel alone typically accounts for something like 38% of the May box office. So if you just eliminate the one Marvel movie from any given previous year for the last decade or so, the box office is down almost 40%. That would look very bad. That would look depressing. That would be a big problem for movie theaters. And so I think we are probably on our way back to something that looks a little bit normal. And if, you know, you look at you believe the kind of Mendelsohn line that, like, movies that you expect to perform do perform still, then we'll be in a situation in which the viewers will come back, things will be okay, it will be after a period of kind of post-surgical recovery. And that's, you know, a year from now, we could just be looking at 2024 and saying, well, it wasn't great, but it wasn't catastrophic, and people were freaking out because of a sort of weird bad 6 weeks opening of the summer.
Yeah, I do think a lot of the death of the box office talk is overstated. There have always been flops. That the Fall Guy failed to do what, you know, we would have liked it to have done is not that surprising. That Furiosa did worse is even less surprising, frankly. That's a movie that you probably could have smelled underperformance on from a mile away, because the original, or the first Fury Road, Mad Max Fury Road, wasn't exactly a huge, enormous hit. It did okay. It did just okay. And there are hits coming down the pike. Bad Boys 4 is performing about like you would expect it to compared
maybe
to Bad
even
Boys
a little
2.
Better.
The Inside Out 2 is outselling Inside Out. That movie's going to do very well. Deadpool versus Wolverine is going to do very well, I think.
Is it versus? Isn't it just and?
Deadpool and
I think
the
we
Magnificent.
Have, we should
some
start
combination at, of Deadpool and Wolverine.
Yeah. Our house style should be Deadpool x Wolverine.
Deadpool v Wolverine v Cyclops.
Just
whatever.
Like
whatever
Godzilla
the,
x Kong.
Whatever the style
Wolf
is
pulled.
There. But I think it's I'm trying to make a serious point here. Knock it off. The real issue here is that there is no margin for error anymore for these theater chains. There is less cushion than there used to be because things are so tight all around. And look, the Draft House is a volume. All movie theaters are volume businesses, but the Draft House in particular was a place where, like, people came and ate and drank, and they needed those seats to be filled. Having, you know, 9/10 empty auditoriums all the time just doesn't work for them. And that's and I think you're going to see more and more of that in the coming months and weeks. I do think that there's going to be a lot of that sort of thing. It's bad. That's bad.
If you are a listener to this podcast, go to your local Draft House and order an extra beer, maybe two. Order another set of chicken fingers, because that's where movie theaters make their money, is off the concessions, because they're splitting the box office with the studios. So pay for that extra beer. Pay for that pizza.
Alyssa, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, I mean, the other thing about Peter's surgery metaphor is that you can have surgery, you can have a recovery period and come back fundamentally healthy, but maybe not at the capacity that you used to have, right? I mean, if you...
That's the plot of Challengers.
Indeed. And so, you know, it's possible that the movie business is going to shrink some and arrive at a new equilibrium in which movies are not gone, theaters are not gone, but where consumers have somewhat fewer choices. And maybe there are fewer of these specialty chains that do the kinds of, you know, careful presentation and high level service that we appreciate, that our listeners appreciate. So I think it's entirely possible that movies survive. I don't think that I I think, in fact, it is likely that movies survive. Like, for all this, you know, worrying about them, they're a very popular form of entertainment that make a lot of money for people. But I do think the business may be in a period of correction where it ends up somewhat smaller, and that would be a bummer. Sonny should always have an Alamo Drafthouse to go to, but, you know...
Yeah, this is really all about me. There hasn't been enough empathy for my plight here.
So many solutions.
No, you didn't offer me solutions. You said move your family back across the country to go to the theater. I want the theater to come to me. That's I don't live there. That's doesn't work for me anymore. All right, I don't really have an exit cons or nons question here, so I'll just wrap up by saying if I had to guess. Some of the local DFW draft houses will reopen. I am worried that my personal one, the one that's 5 minutes from my house, will not, because my understanding it is that it was one of the low performing ones. But we'll see. Still, I feel like Tony Soprano, man. I came in at the end. The best is over. It's all downhill from here.
You can buy the empty draft house and turn it into your bada bing.
Once again, if anybody is listening to this podcast and is a huge fan and really wants to throw some money down a sinkhole, I got a great investment opportunity for you. Just hit me up on my email. We'll work something out. All right. Make sure to swing by for our bonus episode on Friday when we're going to do a deep dive on Will Smith, who's back on top of the box office with this week's Bad Boys Ride or Die. Huge hit. People love it. People love Will Smith. Speaking of which and whom, on to the main event. Bad Boys Ride or Die, starring Will Smith as Detective Mike Lowry and Martin Lawrence as Detective Marcus Miles Burnett. The Bad Boys are getting older. They're getting older, but they wouldn't say they're too old for this, you know, stuff. Despite the fact that Mike is finally settling down and getting married, and the fact that Marcus, as the film begins, suffers a heart attack, they're still as wild as ever. And this time around, they got to clear the good name of the recently departed Captain Howard, played by Joey Pantoliano, Joey Pants, as a sort of force ghost who appears to Marcus from beyond the grave in a vision to tell him that now is not his time to die. And also, you guys, there's trouble coming. There's trouble coming for you. Look out for that. And then he sends them a text message. Very nice. He sends them a video text message. It was triggered by corrupt public officials trying to plant evidence on Howard to implicate him from beyond the grave in their own schemes. What is that scheme? Couldn't really tell you. I gotta be honest. It's not that the plot is complicated as so much as non-existent. Like, on the one hand, it's pretty straightforward, right? Corrupt cops, corrupt assistant attorneys. They're allowing drug importation. And they're taking bribes, and they're also working with the cartels to stop 9/11 2.0. Sure, why not? It wasn't entirely clear to me if they were...
And they have an alligator-themed theme park.
The alligator theme park is so great.
Unclear to me if they owned the alligator-themed theme park or if they were just squatting on it. Either way.
It's unfortunate that this movie doesn't take advantage of the Burmese python's takeover of the Everglades. That's my main complaint.
Okay. None of this matters. None of any of these things that we're discussing really matters, because this is a buddy cop hangout movie, and all that really matters is how much we enjoy hanging out with Mike and Marcus. And I want to say a word about charisma here, about Riz. Is that how the kids say it? Screen presence. Because if you go through this script line by line, you go on a line by line level through this movie, there's nothing that jumps out at you as particularly clever. Aside from a running gag about how Marcus and his near-death experience came to understand that he and Mike have been friends for generations in a variety of lives and a variety of guises, it's pretty standard back-and-forth stuff. But it works. It's actually genuinely compelling when Lawrence and Smith are spouting the platitudes, when they're bantering back and forth. They have it. They just have it. And you compare that to when Rhea Seehorn... is asked to do the same thing. Audiences will remember her from Better Call Saul. She's a very good actress. She's great on that show. She should have won like 10 Emmys. I don't think she won any. Maybe she won one at the end. I can't remember. But when she's asked to perform some of the clunkier dialogue here, I was like, none of this works. There's, again, I don't think this is her fault. she just doesn't have the same sort of charisma, screen presence, partnership that Lawrence and Will Smith have. They are a great team. They are great together. The directing team of Adil and Bilal, that's their name, Adil and Bilal, perfectly merge their own frenetic sensibility with the Michael Bay house style of the Bad Boys films, and they do it in a less winking manner than the first time around. I remember in the first of these movies that they made together, there's the kind of standard spinning 360 parallax shot of them getting out of their car, and one of them opens their car into the fire hydrant, and they're like, oh, what's going on? It's funny because it doesn't work out exactly how you would think. This one, they do a proper 360 Michael Bay spin, no winking. Bay himself does pop up in a winking cameo, and that appealed approximately zero people in my theater. I laughed because I was like, Michael Bay, I like you. You're fun. You're driving a Porsche. That's great. Silence in my theater otherwise. So, Michael Bay not getting the respect he deserves. I would like to highlight the use of drone cameras in this film because we are getting closer and closer to an actual idea of how to use drone cameras in movies like this. There's this great moment in an artistic space. It's like a big artist's warehouse where there are lots of paintings and, you know, projectors and whatever. There's a shootout going on. They have a pilot camera go all around while the gunfight is taking place, and the shot gives us a complete and immediate sense of location and space while also playing out like a completed shot. All too often, these drone shots look like they're going somewhere and then stop abruptly and cut to someplace else. Michael Bay's Ambulance did this a lot. It was super frenetic. He was just in love with this idea of like looping and swooping, like doing 360s and spins in the air. It's like you could imagine him just like sitting in his director's chair going, and now I want it to go like like that. And that was how that felt. This felt much more steady, much more, kind of well thought out. It's funny watching this movie, watching this Bad Boys movie triggered a weird sense of nostalgia in me. Not so much for the film itself or the characters. I've always been kind of cold on the series. And I frankly was watching this one in the theater and like, was surprised to be reminded that the third entry involved Mike discovering he had an illegitimate son who was a hitman for the cartels or some such. That whole thing was absurd. But it was this weird nostalgia for like movie going itself, right? Bad Boys for Life came out in January 2020. It was kind of sort of the last big release right before COVID, not counting some family stuff like Sonic the Hedgehog.
It was the biggest movie of 2020 at the box office.
It was literally the highest grossing movie at the box office. 2 months after its release, theaters shut down all over the country. The industry would sputter to a halt. Things got bad and have not gotten better since. So, I was thinking about that a lot while I was watching the movie. Peter, what did you make of Bad Boys Ride or Die?
Well, my main complaint about it is that they used the title Bad Boys for Life on the third film.
Yes.
And it could have been Bad Boys for Life for
yes.
the fourth film with a number four there. And this is just a big miss, in my opinion. I get it that it's Bad Boys for Life. We ride together, we die together, and the for life comes first. But come on, there's a numerical name pun that could have been made, and they botched it. I didn't hate this movie by any stretch. I found Martin Lawrence and Will Smith to be about as charming as ever. But the movie struck me as just okay. And it's in particular is just okay in the way that basically every single thing that happens in this movie is a reflection in some way of a beat from the previous movie, from the first one of the sort of not reboot, but the sort of legacy sequel series in 2020. It just like the sun is shoehorned into this plot in a way that makes absolutely no sense. And the sun character has essentially no charisma at all. It was just a sort of, he's there because he was in the last one, I guess. I don't know. I also, do you guys remember in the third one, his mom was a witch? What? Like,
sure.
Just, anyway, it felt kind of rehashy to me in a, and not particularly inspired. Now, maybe this isn't the kind of franchise or movie that you're like, oh, inspiration, Peter, really? Is that what you expect? But go back to the first Bad Boys. Go back to the second Bad Boys, the two Michael Bay entries. Those movies are absurd in the best possible way, especially the second one. There's a bit in the beginning of the third act, like when they're planning out the third act heist, I don't know, crazy action sequence from in the in Bad Boys 2. And I'm pretty sure it's Henry Rollins, you know, the lead, the punk rock lead singer from like Black Flag and Rollins Band, because he's in that movie. He's like the sort of the tactical leader guy who's explaining what they're going to do. Maybe it's actually Will Smith who says this. It's been a little while since I've seen this. Anyway, their plan is to infiltrate this drug lord's mansion. And he's like, here is a bag of cats and iguanas, and we're going to throw it over the wall. And let it trigger all of this. Like, this is the movie. It's like, it's a bag of cats and iguanas is the start to this action scene. And then it just, like, at the end, they're in a Humvee, like, going down a hill, crashing through, like, an entire country.
Favela.
Like,
at
the, like, just, like, the whole country is being destroyed by, like, maybe there's a couple of Humvees. It's, like, and it's so crazy and so over the top in a way that is really funny, because it's just straight up like vulgar, ridiculous nonsense. But also, this is Michael Bay saying, on the one hand, I enjoy this because this is fun. And on the other hand, you guys are always making fun of my movies for being ridiculous and over the top. Well, I'll show you ridiculous and over the top. He is, it's both a flex and a self-parody at the same time. And it's kind of phenomenal in its, it, just in its bizarre, vulgar intensity. And I did not feel like either of these two recent installments had that, and especially this one, in the way that it just sort of, that it just kind of repeats the beats from Bad Boys for Life and says, that movie was a success in the modern era. That movie showed what we want to do with the older versions of these guys. Let's just do that more or less again. And you get the alligator farm sequence at the end. It's pretty fun. There's some good drone photography. There's some pretty fun bits with a gun cam where they've basically hooked up a rig, like almost like a Steadicam rig to Will Smith and his gun. And they're shooting the scene from the angle of his gun. It's inventive. It's clever, you know, in its way. But there's just not enough to the movie beyond some funny-ish, you know, back and forth between Lawrence and Will Smith, and some, I would say, reasonably innovative but not truly startling or striking action sequences.
Yeah.
So it's okay, but it's not. It's
fine.
It is fine. It's just fine. It's just okay. But man, the Fall Guy and Furiosa are so much better. And you didn't go see them.
Yeah. Alyssa, what did you make of Bad Boys 4, but not For Life? Bad Boys Ride or Die.
This is amiably dumb. I didn't care about the plot at all, but the parts of the movie that are all of the characters hanging out are quite enjoyable, right? I mean, like, Martin Lawrence just riffing on, like, how he can't die, and he's lived a bunch of past lives, just enjoyable. As is the running joke with his son-in-law, who's, like, an incredibly quiet, mild-mannered, henpecked by Marcus, unbelievably murderous killer Marine.
Yeah.
Like, the essence of the movie
is... one note, that is the same kid who shows up for the date in the very first film.
Yeah,
it's the same actor, I believe.
And these are the only movies he's ever done. But like, the essence of the movie is the postscript where where Marcus and Mike are jawing over who gets to use the grill at the public park, and Reggie, the son-in-law, shows up and is like, I'd like to cook my chicken, and they argue about it for a while, and then they're like, oh, he killed 13 people. It's like, he gets to cook the chicken, right? It's like, I mean, as you know, to the extent that these are like a hangout movie that allow like black men to be loose and goofy and like kind of vulnerable and like periodically sort of like have deep talks about things, like, I find that enjoyable. I don't care about them like as action movies at all. I have no particular attachment to this franchise. But you know what? Sometimes in early June, you need something that's kind of like lightweight and stupid. And I will not remember anything about this movie within 48 hours of us talking about it, except the barbecue scene at the end. That's okay.
That's safe bet. No, this is like perfect disposable Hollywood entertainment. It really is. And there's something to be said for that. Like, not everything has to be a masterpiece. And not everything, and most things shouldn't be terrible. A lot of things can be, like, just pleasant to watch. Just a pleasant watch. And yeah, I'm fine with that.
In a way, the thing that I think is most sort of interesting about this, my friend Joe Gross, critic based in Texas, you know, tweeted that it's like, you know, this movie has basically, like, made back its budget because it cost, as someone put it, only $100 million. Yeah. And his, you know, he made the point, it's like, the fact that we can talk about movies as costing only $100 million is bananas. And look, you know, there was, during COVID and immediately after, cost shot up a lot because of testing protocols, isolation protocols, those were expensive. Inflation has genuinely been a thing. But the idea that we are sort of really psychologically accustomed to movies costing $200 million is maybe not great. And maybe more things would be successful if, like, we kind of had a mental cap of $100 million. Like, thanks to drone photography, you can do some cool-looking stuff for $100 million. You can't, like, summon up, like, I don't know, a giant alien dinosaur or a bunch of apes for, maybe you can't do that for $100 million, but there's a lot of stuff you can do for $100 million when you also have enjoyable stars at the middle of the movie. And I mean, again, like, I know that I have been, you know, moaning about this for practically the entire time we've been podcasting together, but, like, you know, it would be good if some movies could be made for less money and thus had a lower threshold of success. It's just a thought.
That's also part of the franchise. If you recall, the, you know, the first film was Michael Bay's debut, and that was back in the 1990s when a young upstart filmmaker making his first, it's a big studio film with, like, at that time Martin Lawrence was if anything as sort
bigger
of equally
star.
Big yeah. star, maybe even bigger than Will Smith, but, like, he did not start by making you know, Jurassic Park or something, right? Whatever the equivalent was in the 1990s, and the budget on that movie was, this is not adjusted for inflation, please don't ask me, is that adjusted for inflation? The budget was something like $20 to $25 million in 1995 dollars. You know, so whatever that is today, I think it was lower than that. I was like
19 to 23.
20 to 25. All right. So it's like $20 million, right? So this is like the equivalent of making a movie for $40 or $50 million today. It's a little bit different, right? Like, that, just because things cost. But, like, that adjusted for inflation, that's probably somewhere in the range of $40 to $60 million. And so this movie is, you know, sort of participating in a lineage of, like, these movies did not cost a zillion dollars to begin with. I think it was actually only the second one that was really quite expensive.
Yeah. Yeah. I would argue that Will Smith was actually second fiddle to Martin Lawrence in this movie. I mean, it depends on how you want to think about how popular Fresh Prince of Bel-Air versus Martin was, but I don't know.
Will Smith had not yet become Will Smith as we know him. The original Bad Boys was a big part of his breakout as a box office star who could...
Well, the year after that, he made Independence Day. The year after that, he made Men in Black. And that's when he became Will Smith, capital W, capital S. I guess he was always capital W, capital S, because it's a name. But, you know, the Will Smith Experience, capital
yes.
E.
Millennium.
Well, the Millennium was a few years later, and that was the beginning.
The Millennium was upon us. It was dawning.
The Millennium, the era of Will Smith. All right.
Welcome to Miami.
I would, all right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Bad Boys, Ride or Die? Peter.
A grudging thumbs up, I guess. This is not a movie I actually want to, like, care to watch again, whereas the first two Bad Boys films I have seen at least a half a dozen times each.
Alyssa.
So what you're saying is you hated them, since we know that you watch everything a billion times. No. Yeah, I would say, like, again, sort of like marginally thumbs up. It probably would have been slightly higher if I'd drunk a beer while seeing it.
Thumbs up. It's fine. This fine. Again, I want more movies to just be like, I enjoy spending time watching guys like Will Smith and Martin Lawrence on screen. That's fine. That's good enough for me, because I have low expectations. I've been trained to just go for whatever. Who cares? All right, that's it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter, @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.